Congress is set to extend a key tax cut.
But will it help the economy?
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Adrienne Hill in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Friday, January 17th.
Coming up, I'll talk with the CEO of Ford.
And reality TV shows head south.
Plus, why Dolly Parton is cashing in every time I Will Always Love You is on the radio.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
We start in Washington, where lawmakers are expected to pass an extension of the payroll tax holiday. The cut is worth about $1,000 a year to the average family. And economists are hoping the extra money could stimulate the economy. But as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports, there's a problem with the plan. Rising gas prices.
At a national average of $3.52 a gallon, gasoline prices have jumped 8% this year.
Increasing gasoline prices just in the first 6 weeks of this year have already reduced monthly household income by about $40.
That's Trevor Hauser, an economist at the economic research firm Rhodium Group. With the average family getting around $85 a month from the payroll tax holiday, already almost half has been eaten up by gasoline. And if prices hit $4 a gallon by this summer?
If we get that much of an increase again, that will have pretty much completely eroded the effects of the payroll tax cut.
So much for economic stimulus. Economist Chris Christopher at IHS Global Insight says there is one way to avoid some of the drain on the household budget.
As gas prices go up, and they're going to go up, people tend to shop more at home.
Putting computers and smartphones to work and letting UPS, FedEx, and the post office struggle with prices at the pump. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The cost of the payroll tax cut deal is somewhere in the neighborhood of $140 billion. Lawmakers are hoping to help pay for part of it by auctioning off spectrum. That's the airwave wireless phone companies want to speed up their networks. To help us make sense of the news, we've got Politico tech reporter Tony Rahm with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's start with the basics here. What is this spectrum we're going to auction? What are we talking about?
We're talking about the lifeblood for wireless companies, those invisible airwaves that allow your iPhones and Blackberries and Androids to be able to access the internet and to share email. You know, as millions and millions more Americans and others begin to use smartphones and try to download more and more data, there's been a crunch. So wireless carriers have looked the federal government to free up more spectrum, while at the same time the federal government has looked to unleash those airwaves as one way to raise money to address the deficit.
And I understand television broadcasters have a lot of this spectrum now, is that right?
Absolutely. The entire idea behind what's called incentive auctions is recouping airwaves from broadcasters and then selling them to wireless companies.
And so what's this auction going to mean to those of us who aren't wireless providers? What's it going to mean to us regular people?
Well, in the next couple of days, probably not much. We're talking months, if not years, before the FCC can get the spectrum and then begin to sell it to wireless companies. But over a period of time, what it probably means is, you know, if you're in a city and you're trying to use your smartphone, maybe it goes a little bit faster. Maybe you don't have those problems with congestion that sometimes slows down your phone and results in dropped calls.
Tony Rahm from Politico, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Campbell Soup said today that its income fell in the last couple months. It is struggling with rising costs, as a lot of food companies are. Marketplace's Eve Troh reports some of those companies are looking to pass that increase on to consumers.
When a food company raises prices, customers look elsewhere. So to keep eyeballs on your brand, you want to keep prices at bay. But that's hard to do as costs rise for raw ingredients, says Ken Perkins at Morningstar.
Now there's sort of a dilemma between, do we raise our prices and risk alienating consumers from our brands, or do we let our profits slide?
And alienate shareholders. Companies have been exploring their options, innovating shiny new products to spur demand, or keeping the price of a product the same, but getting sneaky on the size.
the hope was that if you took an ounce or two out of the bottle, it wouldn't make that much of a difference. The consumer wouldn't notice, really.
That's John Frank at Mintel International. He says the big brands could also cut their marketing budgets, but they risk losing ground to the grocery store's own brands.
A lot of supermarkets are stressing and marketing their private label much more actively today.
And they're making those store brands taste better, because if the big names do jump in price, more customers could switch to the store brands for the long haul. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Now to Paris, where Britain and France will sign a deal that'll pave the way for new nuclear power plants in the UK. It's one of the first big commitments to nuclear energy since the Fukushima disaster in Japan. For more, we have the BBC's Paris correspondent Hugh Schofield with us now. Good morning, Hugh.
Good morning.
So why are Britain and France working on this nuclear deal together today?
Well, France has a long history in nuclear power and is the kind of preeminent player in nuclear power in Europe. Britain, which does have some nuclear power stations, wants to renew its stock of nuclear power. It wants to start building. And for that, it needs French know-how. French companies already heavily invested in the British energy infrastructure. They've bought into British power companies, and now they're going to go further. And the big French names are going to be helping build, basically, this new generation of British power stations.
Now, after the Fukushima disaster in Japan, Germany actually decided to phase out nuclear power. Why are Britain and France moving in the opposite direction here?
It's very much about national sensibilities. Germany has always been very, very sensitive on the issue of nuclear power and has a very, very strong green movement that's opposed to it. Those forces are much less prevalent in France and Britain. They're not there, but they're not nearly as powerful. The sort of greater general feeling is that in Britain and France, I think, is that nuclear power has to be part of the mix.
The BBC's Hugh Schofield, thanks.
Thank you.
In Washington, D.C., there's a guy named Danny White, and he has vanity license plates that say no tags. Now, to him, Adrian, it's a joke, but when the city issues a traffic ticket for a car that has no license plates, or tags, as they're sometimes called, the ticket goes to Danny White. He says he's gotten $20,000 worth of tickets over the years, and he tells WRC-TV in Washington that he's constantly having to go to court to get them dismissed. Now, he does say he will change the license plates that he has on his car if they pay for it, which they have apparently so far not taken him up on.
It seems like that's a small cost to pay in exchange for not having this guy show up in court every other
month. Yeah, but it's a better
whatever.
Story, I guess, this way.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
We're a little more than a week away from a decisive moment in the race for the White House. I'm talking about Michigan's Republican primary, which polls indicate is going to be a tight race between Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum.
Now, as part of our election coverage of the real economy, I'm going to be broadcasting live from Michigan next week. And today we kick things off with the CEO of one of that state's largest and oldest companies, Ford. In today's Midday Extra, we have an extended conversation now with CEO Alan Mulally. He joins us from Detroit. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome, Jeremy. Thank you.
Well, it seems from outside Detroit that the city, the auto industry, is seeing a real comeback. Do you think that is true, and are you hiring in a big way?
Well, I think, clearly, Jeremy, in Ford's case, we are now profitably growing the corporation in the United States and worldwide. And to your point, we have been through probably the worst recession since the Depression, but as you know, Ford chose to invest and even accelerate the investment in the new products during the worst of that recession. So that's why we're in the position today where we probably have the finest lineup of cars and trucks, and we have them now available for everybody as the economy starts to come back and they need their new fuel-efficient vehicles.
And, of course, Ford is the only one of the big three American automakers that avoided bankruptcy after the financial crisis. What do you think, looking back now, that your company did differently that allowed it to emerge without going through bankruptcy?
We borrowed nearly $23.5 billion in 2006, to restructure the business to get back to profitability, and then to accelerate the investment in our new vehicles for everybody. And so we started that process. None of us ever anticipated that the economy would slow down as much as it did. And as you pointed out, that resulted in our competitors going into bankruptcy at the time for the good of the industry and also to help the United States not go from a recession into a depression. We did testify on behalf of our competitors. We clearly didn't need the money, and we were well along in our restructuring and our investment in the new products. But for the good of the United States, we thought that was the right thing to do, and now we're very pleased to not have used precious taxpayer money and to have this fabulous lineup of world-class products for our consumers today.
But you're saying that you were able to do that in part because you took out a big loan at a good time, at the right time.
Well, that's absolutely a key part of the plan. But remember, Jeremy, we also chose to invest in developing the new products that people really do want and value. And we started that over 5 years ago. So we simplified the Ford product line. We divested Aston Martin and Jaguar and Land Rover and Volvo, 100% focused on the Ford product line and Lincoln, but also a commitment to best-in-class family of vehicles in terms of quality and fuel efficiency and safety and really smart design, because we believed that that's what the consumers would really want and value. So we started that all over 5 years ago.
Well, you mentioned small, medium, and large vehicles. So I want to ask you, what is the future of Ford and the other automakers? Is it small, fuel-efficient cars, or is it trucks? Because it seems like for all the talk of small cars, people are still really in love with their pickup trucks.
Well, in Ford's case, our commitment to the consumers is that when you walk into a Ford store, you can choose a vehicle that works for your lifestyle. And if you look at the market throughout the United States, about 50% are cars and about 50% are crossovers and larger SUVs and trucks. And so we are mirroring what the market really does want, but with a complete family of vehicles.
But do you see that as the long-term trend? Do you think 20 years from now it's still going to be a 50-50 split between larger cars and smaller cars?
We have taken a long-term view that we all will pay more for energy going forward, which is why with Ford you can get the vehicle of the size that you want, knowing that every vehicle is more efficient. But I think over time we are going to be paying more for energy.
How important are the emerging markets like China to Ford?
Very important. We're expanding dramatically in Asia Pacific, especially in India and Indonesia and China and Malaysia. And also we're expanding in Europe, especially in Russia, which will be the largest market in Europe over the next couple of years, as well as our strong presence in North America and South America.
Have you been hurt by the European debt crisis?
Well, I think everybody is experiencing the slowdown associated with the sovereign debt issues in Europe. We're very encouraged that the leadership is dealing with them, and we hope that they'll continue to deal with them decisively, because the economy is continuing to slow down in Europe because of the sovereign debt issues.
A lot of people view you as a hero for turning the company around, and as a result of your work, you received more than $50 million in stock last year. Do you see anything wrong with a CEO making that much more than the rest of the company workforce?
Well, I appreciate your comments about the importance of leadership. I think the neat thing about the Ford plan is that we have all of the Ford employees are compensated in terms of the company's performance. So as we create an exciting, viable, profitably growing company, everybody is associated with the same performance criteria. And remember, in Ford's case, our objective was to create and is to continue to create an exciting, viable, profitably growing company for the good of all of us. So we want everybody associated with Ford to be lined up with the performance, including our suppliers, the unions, our employees, and our dealers. And that's the way our whole compensation system is set up. And I'm very pleased that everybody associated with our Ford now is benefiting from a profitably growing company.
And indeed, what you're saying is absolutely true. You have raised the salaries for your employees. But do you think that there's a problem with a CEO making so much more? Some people look at that and they really, it opens their eyes a little bit.
Well, I think all the compensation is market-driven and is competitive, and we are absolutely committed to to being competitive in every element of our business and all the skills that we employ.
It seems like every time money is tight, the first place that big companies focus to cut their costs, and you said early on that this is something that you guys did in the early days of the financial crisis, is you have to cut benefits, you have to cut salaries, and sometimes those salaries and benefits are not made up when things get better. Is that your sense?
Well, I think, clearly everybody sacrificed as we went through this recession, and we did the right thing to not only save the company, but create a company that now has a very strong foundation to be able to grow. And again, all of our wages and benefits in every element of the business is benchmarked against the best in the world. And the most important thing that we continue to do is to ensure that we absolutely are competitive at every element of our business, because that is the reason that we are growing now. We have announced over the next 3 or 4 years we're going to be adding 12,000 new hourly jobs. We're going to be all kinds of engineering jobs, manufacturing, because we are competitive. And from a United States point of view, we are now exporting vehicles from the United States around the world because we have continued to keep our eye on every element of competitiveness, including wages and benefits.
How big a role do you think auto companies and the manufacturing sector in general is going to play in America's economic future?
Well, I think it's really important. I think that we know over the years countries that have a really strong manufacturing base, that is the fundamental of economic development. I might, point out, Jeremy, that nearly 70% of all the research and development in the United States and around the world is associated with manufacturing. And it's like manufacturing with a big M. So the research, the engineering, the innovation, the technology, I mean, these are fabulous, fabulous vehicles and fabulous careers. And so the fact that we are contributing to economic development, we're also a major part of the solution for energy independence and energy security. And we're also a major part of the solution for environmental sustainability. So, again, when you walk in that Ford store, whether you need a petrol version, a diesel, a hybrid, a plug-in hybrid, an all-electric, smaller vehicles all the way up to larger ones, that you're going to get the best-in-class vehicles now from Ford. So we're very proud of our contribution to the economy and energy independence and sustainability.
So we are going to be in Michigan all next week. What is the one thing, do you think, that exists in that state that doesn't exist anywhere else in the country?
Well, I think that the focus on economic development and creating a business environment that is conducive and fosters business growth is just so, so important. We're in a global marketplace. The people that are going to do well are the ones that make products and services that people really do want and value. And they do it with higher quality, and they do it more productively. And so the public-private partnership that creates an environment where businesses can be competitive and they can grow are going to be the ones that create great jobs and great careers and also contribute to the big issues that all of us in the United States care about, like economic development and energy independence and security and also environmental sustainability. So it's that public-private partnership to create that kind of environment.
Alan Mulally is the CEO of Ford. Mr. Mulally, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome, Jeremy. Thank you.
The 20th season of The Amazing Race starts Sunday, adding a whole new roster of reality TV stars to a crowded cohort. We've already got seemingly unlimited Real Housewives, dozens of chefs and designers and folks who sell wedding dresses. Now producers are casting a broader net for stories and for voices. Kate Archer Kent of Red River Radio reports.
37-year-old Amy Pitts is an office secretary. She'll be the first to tell you she's a hick. She went deer hunting before our interview.
We are country rednecks. You know, we love to be in the woods or on the water or definitely outside. Everything is outside.
But last summer, she left her comfort zone for 5 weeks. Pitts and a dozen family members lived in a beach mansion in East Hampton, New York, shooting CMT's reality TV series, My Big Redneck Vacation. The family played polo, dined at hoity-toity restaurants with help from an etiquette coach, and socialized with highfalutin society folk. Pitts says the contrasting lifestyles made for funny TV.
I think Louisiana just got discovered for the reality world. You know, they realized there is a whole nother world here. And we do have some characters, that's no doubt.
CMT enjoyed its highest ratings ever when My Big Redneck Vacation debuted last month alongside another reality show featuring a Louisiana family. It's called Bayou Billionaires. CMT Vice President Louis Bogash says producers are finally discovering quirky characters in the Deep South.
We sort of have spent the last however many years, 50 years, being sort of locked into Los Angeles and New York, and there's a whole country out there.
Louisiana appreciates the attention, but what the state really wants are big-budget productions, like movies and scripted TV series. Chris Stelly is the head of film development for Louisiana. He says reality TV projects don't normally hit the state's $300,000 threshold to qualify for tax credits.
Overall, in our total book of business, reality shows are really less than 10% of everything that we do.
Louis Bogash doesn't know where CMT will take the redneck theme next, but as a New Yorker, he says it's refreshing to produce shows starring people who aren't so stressed and uptight, like himself. In Shreveport, Louisiana, I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace.
Mourners will gather in New Jersey this weekend for Whitney Houston's funeral. Now, ever since her death, Houston's crystal clear rendition of I Will Always Love You has been everywhere on the radio, all over the place. But most of the money that goes along with heavy radio play and strong sales isn't going to Houston's estate. Marketplace's Heidi Moore reports.
Whitney Houston's soaring voice made that song a huge hit. For Dolly Parton, the country singer wrote it and gets 8 cents every time it's on the radio. I Will Always Love You is an example of how the music industry works. Whitney's performance may be famous, but the songwriting is where the real fortune is made. Greg Guglia is a copyright lawyer at the law firm Duane Morris. He says this happens all the time. Take Carole King.
James Taylor recorded Carole King's You've Got a Friend. They were actually friends, so they discussed it.
Houston's estate will still make money from album sales. Dolly Parton's estate will still make money no matter what. Todd Brabeck with BMG Chrysalis Publishing has handled the royalties for the estates of Irving Berlin, Jim Morrison, and Tupac Shakur.
The death of a creator, whether it's an artist or a writer, does not stop the royalties.
It turns out music is immortal, not just artistically, but financially. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
And finally, Jeremy, to suburban Detroit, where a speed limit sign told drivers to slow down on school days. If your morning commute takes you past a school, you've probably seen this kind of thing. You know what I'm talking about? 25 miles an hour school
zone
signs.
Yeah, you got to stay slow when you're going by the school zone. Yeah.
Yeah. So what made this sign different is that it included six sets of times when the rule applies. And this is like 6:49 to 7:15, 7:52 to 8:22. 8:37 to 9:07 and on.
That's
and
pretty
on.
Specific. Yeah.
The Oakland Press says a frustrated driver complained, making the point that to actually read the sign, you'd need to stop.
Sure.
Turns out officials listened. The guy was right. They've replaced the sign.
Well, there you go. I mean, you know, I drive down, Melrose in Los Angeles sometimes, and every turn you have to, it says you can't go between, 4 and 7 p.m. or whatever.
Right, you can't turn left.
Yeah, if there were more information on that sign, I'm not sure I'd be able to handle that either at a moving speed. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.